This is Barbara Peters, and it is January 10th, 2019, and I am once again thrilled to be hosting Thomas Perry, who's one of my favorite authors, and possibly, gosh, Tom, how long is it you've been coming to do these events with us at the Poison Pen?
Only about 25 years or so.
I thought we'd been aging together in a sort of graceful fashion. Well, we've been through any number, because you're not an author that I would describe as... Well, you are consistent in the sense of how I think you craft your characters and the quality of your writing, but you keep like to going off in different directions.
I do. I've been blessed with a short attention span, so I manage to keep myself happy by, you know, doing something different each year. You know, essentially, I've been writing a book a year for, I don't know, very long time.
Well, at least 25 years, which is why we've been together so long.
That's right. Yeah, that's true. This is my 26th book, so I guess that would be true. But, you know, I do find that I like to explore something new whenever I can. And newness is fun. It keeps me learning. It keeps me forced to do some research and to find things out and to listen to people and so on. So it's really been good for me to do that.
You've gone into all kinds of different businesses and cultures, you know, anywhere from assassins to art thieves to, you know, Eastern European thugs to serial killers and on. But, you know, strangely enough, because the Jane Whitefields are the one series that you've really done, right?
Yeah.
There are six now?
I think there are eight now.
Maybe it's that. Yeah. I remember it was originally five. That was the original thing. You signed up for a quintet. But then, right. Have you done three sequels now since?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Because what happens is that people start to write to me and say, when's the next Jane book coming out? And then I finally got one time that said, have you retired or are you dead? And then, so I decided that those weren't good choices, mm-hmm. So I would write another one. And so every once in a while I write one. And but lately I've sort of been... goofing off. I haven't written any of those for a while.
Well, see, now that was the point I wanted to talk to you about, because really, reading about, are we pronouncing it Ellie? What do you want to call her? Elle Stoll.
Uh-huh.
She's really got many of the same skill sets and same attitudes that Jane has.
Well, they're related.
They are.
Through their father. But, no, I find that true, sort of in retrospect. I think, you know, I didn't intend to do that, really, but it was something that that does sort of come out. I like sort of characters who surprise their opponents, and both of them, you know, partly just because they're women, but they do sort of have that quality of being able to take advantage of someone else's mistaken opinion of them.
Well, I find them mission-oriented. She is in her different way. They like to work in unconventional ways. They have carefully honed a skill set that involves both physical action and tools.
Mm-hmm.
And they also master their environment. So, you know, when Jane was making people disappear, she was very careful to map everything out. Mm-hmm. And it's also true of Elle. There she is in Beverly Hills trying to look like she's part of the neighborhood. Not in a residential way, but more in terms of, you know, the people who show up to walk the dogs. Well, that's the deal.
Yeah.
But she too has done what Jane does, which is to map out her physical environment,
mm-hmm.
and then that helps her deal with when people are chasing her.
Right.
So I felt very much, you know, so I were reading Jane, except in a different context.
Yeah, well, that's good. In a way, she's sort of an anti-Jane, because she's in it for selfish reasons.
Right. And
she's a person who, she's sort of a feral girl, you know what I mean? She's like a feral cat or something. I mean, she was, you know, had her sort of her criminal family move away without telling her when she was 14, and so she's been basically stealing to eat since then. And she's gotten very, very good at it. And she, you know, isn't stealing food; she's stealing diamonds and things these days because she knows how to do that. But you know, I never wanted to lose the idea that she's a person who's sort of forced into that situation. You
know, well, no, she's clearly doing this by choice. And of course, the other obvious aspect of that is if she worked that hard at a legitimate job, you know, she'd probably be doing fairly well. So there must be something. Is she like adrenaline addicted or risk addicted? What is it that keeps her in this life?
Well, you know, near the end of the book, I have her beginning to think maybe that her time is up, you know, that she's got to start looking for a job after after she runs off with this guy at the end. Because I think at this point she sort of realizes that she's got something to live for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is, what she was doing, being a thief, a perennial, a thief, you can only do till you're about her age. She's about 24. And if what you're going to be doing is jogging around Beverly Hills looking like a daughter of the rich, that only lasts a certain number of years. And, you know, after that, you either have to think of some new scam or grow up.
Well, I think she's time-stamped. I mean, if nothing else, physically, she, as she ages, she won't be up for it. So Beverly Hills would clearly be a place where a thief like her, who filters into people's homes and heads for the master bedroom where the good stuff is, where the pickings would be rich. I mean, this would not be an operation that would be paying off if she were in some, Koreatown or some poorer part of Los Angeles, right?
Right. Right. I mean, this is the place, or these are the places, the parts of Los Angeles where everybody has something worth stealing. You know, you can, whatever it is you can carry is probably worth more than you would, make in a normal year at a normal job. But, there are a lot of ironies to this, too. You can't steal a $200,000 necklace and get $200,000 from a fence for it. You know, you're always essentially feeding other people rather than getting ahead.
Well, so, and you're always also at the mercy of whoever is disposing of your, unless you're running your own pawn shop or money laundering or whatever it is, diamond laundering operation.
Yeah.
You're always going to be vulnerable to betrayal or exploitation, by these people.
Right. So at the, really in the first scene of the book, you may not immediately realize it, but she's heading for the end. You know, she's just about done with this life, and something is going to have to change if she's going to live any longer.
Well, there wouldn't be any point in your writing the book if it were just going to be a chronology of her burglary. Yeah. The other thing I care is any experienced crime reader or editor, for example, like me, would know that if you are going to write a crime novel from the point of view of a burglar, you're inevitably going to have the burglar faced with a dilemma of discovering a worse crime and then being in a poor position to do anything about it. It was absolutely true of Bernie Rodenbauer. I mean, that was always the deal when Larry Black would set Bernie up. He'd break in, there would be a body, can he call the police? Tim Hallinan with Junior Bender, his burglar has a similar thing. So, I knew when I opened this up that there would be, what is it we call it? An instigating incident. I love that word, those two words. Where she would run into something in the course of committing a burglary or just breaking into a house. That was going to present her with a much larger crime and then either put her in danger from the cops or put her in danger from the perp. Or both. I mean, that's just a classic scenario, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's essentially what must happen with a lot of people. I mean, real people who have, some sort of a dishonest way of making a living. But I was thinking about this book because, I was glad I was coming here first because I haven't decided what I want to say about it.
So, so you knew we'd work. You knew you and I would work it out, right?
You did a seminar with me for it.
Yeah, well.
But it's, it is fun. It was a fun thing to do. And it's just a new character, really. It's somebody that I hadn't thought of for a long, really ever until recently. And you do see these people in Los Angeles and other places. Running constantly, and in a way, I was in a position that what's his name, Ross Thomas supposedly used to be, where, you know, he would sit on the beach and see people walk by and wonder about them, right. You know. And if you're in L.A., a lot of times you see people running, and you do wonder about them. You wonder who they are and why they're doing that, you know what I mean? It's the ones that have puzzled me the most are the ones that are running and they're carrying burdens, you know, which is kind of the latest version of the fitness craze, I guess.
Sort of like carrying weights or whatever it is, well, but now they're what?
Backpacks. Are like they? Full, you know, full backpacks.
Yeah.
No, which is, you know, but they aren't the ones that would be like her, you know, but I was thinking to myself, gee, maybe I could use that as a way.
Sure. But, well, yeah, you know. If she's running with a backpack, then that's a good place where she could stash the stuff and see. I mean, you know, but also in contrast to like the old man, for example, she's not only young, but she doesn't really have any, she's not tied into other people.
Right.
You know, so I thought she was a particularly interesting contrast to the old man, but really to Jane also, because Jane, you know, had obligations. And inevitably, if you're going to write, what, 8 books now about Jane, she's going to develop, you know, she has a husband, you know, she's going to have things that are going to make her more interdependent.
Right. She has all kinds of connections in that part of the world, you know, and she's a member of a family and a member of a nation and a, right. You know, a band and so on. It's just
so if you put her and put her into peril, you have to think about that.
Right.
Whereas somebody like Elle, you know, I mean, the truth is, if somebody, you know, whacked her while she was there in the master bedroom,
nobody would know.
Exactly.
Right? Nobody would ever. And it's you know, I think that's something that's been on her mind since the beginning. You know, she's her thinking back on her family, which, you know, that's sort of an all-female household, sort of governed by her grandmother, who is essentially a crook, you know. And I think solving the whole question of who she is in relation to her three aunts and her grandmother is part of her problem. And at the point when she realizes that her grandmother approves of her not because she's really good, but because she's really bad, that maybe it's time to look at it a different way. You know?
Well, you know, crime families are an interesting thing. You've written about, like, the Eastern European group.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very British thing, you know. They have, like, in London, you know, or it goes all the way back to Dickens, right, where you have these whole, or even further, where you have, like, entire clans whose modus operandi. And Joe Gores, when he was writing all those wonderful books about the gypsies, you know.
Right, yeah.
Like 30 whatever Cadillacs and
42 Cadillacs.
Yeah, I mean, I love those books. Yeah. They were wonderful.
Yeah,
but
I did too.
They were a clan devoted to crime, you know, and to developing those skills.
Right, and it was also a kind of complicated series of relationships within the clan, you know, and who is able to do this and who isn't able to do it and so on, and who's the king and who.
Well, you know, it's a softer version, really, of the mafia.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these are not people dedicated to assassination and drug running and all. These are people actually, you know, as we point in the burglary or other, you know, softer crime sphere.
Right.
But they grow up in that in that whole expectation. I was thinking about Dickens the other night because Brad Taylor was here launching his book called Daughter of War, and there's a girl in it. It's just right out of Fagin's Gang and Oliver Twist, you know. And I realized that crime fiction, really, its roots in the 19th century, you know, are still with us, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, what they, you know, Dickens and all those guys, Victor Hugo, you know, the archetypes they wrote about are still true today.
Well, they're being born today. They're being born and growing up and, you know, going to prison one after another and... you know, so we read about them. I mean, we read about them in the newspaper, not necessarily even in old books. It's really crime is unfortunately not imaginary.
No. So you and I, here we are aging gracefully, but I think that, you know, I don't have any plans to retire because, as I often say, what would I do? I don't really see you winding down and not thinking about a new book. At least I hope that's true.
I've got the one for next year finished.
Oh, wonderful.
And I'm working on the one after that right now, sort of halfway in. But yes, I mean, when my wife and I used to work in television, one of our executive producers always said that what he was going to do was, at the moment when he was in the hospital and he was sure he was dying, he would hand whatever manuscript that he had for the next script to his wife and tell her that when he died, she should write freeze frame and fade out and then hand it in. Because then you know, he'd be paid for it. And
so if you ever write a book called Freeze Frame and Fade Out, I should worry. This is like my conversations with John Sanford, who always said, when I'm there, he said, the last Lucas Davenport's going to be called Final Fray. He saw a signal.
Yeah, well, that would be, you know, that's the thing to do. But well, he never, you know, actually, I have enjoyed John's latest things so much, you know, that I'd hate to see him retire, you know.
I think that Virgil has given him, you know, a different sort of universe and slant, and they're so much fun. He says every once in a while, in the same way that Lee Child has over the years threatened, you know, to actually retire, and I always laugh because I have this view, which you're just supporting, that writers write. You know, writers don't just stop writing unless you know, there's some major, again, instigating incident.
No, I think that's true.
You know, how boring would it be if you didn't have a book on the boil?
Yeah, well, you know, John has, I think it was the book, The Virgil Before Last, reads my book, The Old Man, while he's waiting to solve some crime.
Yes.
Which I thought was pretty funny. But I think he did that to make up for chiding me when I went to see him speak at Vroman's. For going to his event wearing, as he put it, a golf shirt. So I think he wanted me to wear a tuxedo or something. So,
now, John's his own guy, you know, and now that he's living in Santa Fe, he's, you know, in a special universe that's different than, let's say, the Twin Cities. We'll see how it goes. But I always look forward to January, Tom, and to seeing you. I'm thrilled you're here.
Well, thank
and
you.
I'm glad we're setting you up for your whole book tour, so you will...
That's right. Now I'll be thinking about which parts of what you said I want to say.
That's a great compliment. Thank you very much.